It would be funny, very comical, if it wasn't so serious. When we watch the President of the United States, Joe Biden, needing note cards for almost everything. He has to reach inside his coat, get note cards out from his staff to remind him what to say. That's serious. President Biden went to King's Orchard's store to purchase a pie or two during his trip through Michigan recently to sell his new infrastructure plan. While he was there, he was asked about the huge ransomware attacks and said that we do not know yet if the Russians had a part in it. But even for that short response, Biden was forced to resort to his notes. It just shows how far the man has declined. We're not sure it was the Russians, Biden said, when asked about the cyber attacks. The journalist who asked this question did not say anything about how insane pulling out a note to answer the question was. The media did not even report this as an issue. They were honed in on the crucial things, like what pies Biden bought and what ice cream he ate in Michigan and how he ate it. When he got to the Moomer's ice cream shop, they were all giddy with Biden getting his favorite flavor and two scoops. "I want a cherry pie and I want an apple pie," he said. President Joe Biden ended his trip to Michigan with a trip to a local ice cream shop. He ordered vanilla ice cream with chocolate chips in a waffle cone and made sure to get two scoops. Remember when the media made such a fuss about Donald Trump asking for two scoops of ice cream? I, in my teenage years, did work at an ice cream store a little while, and I highly approve of President Biden's stop at Moomer's during his visit to Traverse City, Michigan. But he was essentially shoving ice cream down his mouth, and one of the Secret Service guys had a funny reaction to Biden's behavior. He was only hoping he wasn't going to have to do the Heimlich maneuver on him if he started choking. Imagine what the media would have done with this ice cream if that had been Donald Trump. And imagine how unfair that is. We would be hearing about what a greedy pig Trump was. Now it's endearing to the media. Even without the photo of the president, notice how different the news is now on Biden's ice cream versus news about Trump eating two scoops. Now, I understand their mission is to only give softballs to Joe Biden and smooth over all of the negatives to show him to be a pleasant old dude who simply eats his ice cream. But this is very embarrassing, either here in America or on the world stage. This is not journalism. It's stenography. It's essentially writing a press release for Joe Biden. Their job should be to question and keep people in power accountable, not behaving like Democratic operatives. But that's not what we have today in our mainstream media. You need only look back at their coverage of Donald Trump. Whether you like Trump or hate Trump has nothing to do with it. We need honesty from our media. And we don't have that anymore. They are not the least bit interested in anything that would help a conservative. They are only interested in keeping power in the hands of Democrats and people like Joe Biden. It's sad to watch Biden search for his notes to be able to answer whether he's been to the bathroom or not. It's sad. And we are sitting here as sitting ducks because of Biden. And if he was to be pushed out of the way, we've got Kamala Harris. Democrats, Democrats, Democrats. There is much more to the controversy between UNC and the acclaimed journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones than meets the eye. As Bob Lee said, "I believe that red-headed black lady's journalism credentials and her so-called acclaimed 1619 agenda are as fake as her hair color. It is not as cut and dried as the media would have us believe." Susan King, the dean of the UNC School of Journalism, is as left-wing as it gets. It was she who took it upon herself to invite Hannah-Jones to join the UNC faculty. You will never see her approach black Americans like Candace Owens or a Thomas Sowell to present opposing views to her liberalism. I have a different take on this issue of UNC and Nicole Hannah-Jones and her tenure. She was not automatically given tenure at the university, and so she demanded it, or she would not take the job. While she was awaiting that decision, she did not act in good faith in the negotiations. If she was serious about teaching at UNC, if given tenure, she should have waited to see the outcome. Instead, she was secretly working on a position at Howard University, a predominantly black school. It was all a hoax to have the UNC Board of Trustees jumping through hoops in the glare of national publicity. The honorable thing to have done is simply tell UNC that she was no longer interested in their position, but that would not have satisfied her agenda. She as much as said that black professors should teach at predominantly black universities. Why is that not a racist statement? The concern by a few board members at UNC was her racist agenda, and they were right to be concerned. It has nothing to do with the color of her skin or the red hair she chose. If a white professor holds racist views, they too should not be hired at UNC. Hannah-Jones will now take her racist agenda to Howard University, where she will undoubtedly indoctrinate young minds with her agenda. If the UNC board acted out of concern about the color of Hannah-Jones' skin, then they should be ashamed of it. But I believe the concern was not the color of her skin, but the content of her character. In any event, tenure should not be offered to any teacher. A job guarantee, even when the teacher is found to be inept, is a bad idea. I share credit for today's commentary with Bob Lee, Grace Chen of Public School Review, Robert Farrington of Forbes, James Weatherby, and Christopher Beam of Slate for their research and contributions. Did you know that it can take years to fire a public school teacher, even if the instructor is ineffective, has broken laws, or has acted inappropriately sexually towards students? Few would deny that the education system in the United States is ripe for a major overhaul. After all, this country fell from the top spot for education, down below 10th, at about the same place as Lithuania. While many theories have been contemplated about how to raise the bar on the standard of education in this country, one factor appears to be untouched. the quality of the teachers in public schools and universities today. To be sure, there are many great, dedicated teachers in our schools. Those ones are underpaid and unappreciated in many cases. But why the lack of accountability for the bad teachers among them, entrusted with the future of our country and our children? Tenure seems to be the primary answer. Teachers that achieve tenure are difficult to fire, no matter what offenses they may practice in the classroom. As I describe the process to fire inept teachers in many school districts across the country, it becomes easy to see why principals would often rather put up with incompetent teachers than go through the red tape and headaches to replace them. I had a great friend who recently passed away, who spent many years in education, becoming principal of a rural school in North Carolina. He told me many times of the difficulty he encountered getting rid of incompetent teachers. He refused to go along with the practice of many schools of simply palming off these inept teachers to yet another school. That meant he had to tolerate them or go through years of hassle to get them out of the classroom, any classroom. It eventually caused him to leave the field of education for the business world, where he became a giant in the broadcasting industry. According to an article in Newsweek, few inept teachers are ever dismissed from their positions. In 1 year, New York managed to fire only 3 out of more than 30,000 tenured teachers for cause. In Chicago, the number of teachers dismissed for poor performance over 3 years was 0.1%. During that same time frame, Toledo, Ohio dismissed 0.1%. And Akron, Ohio, and Denver, Colorado did not dismiss any. Instead of getting rid of poor performers, principals try to shuffle them into other schools and districts, a process that is known as the Dance of the Lemons by many schools today. Students and their parents have no idea that one school's inept teacher is about to become theirs, due to that shuffle. One reason teachers simply don't get fired is the power of teachers' unions that back them. These organizations were originally designed to protect good teachers from favoritism and nepotism by school principals. However, the process has evolved into one where tenured teachers get armor-clad protection for their positions, no matter how inept they have proven themselves to be in the classroom. Because public education does not work like the rest of the free market, parents are not able to hold schools accountable for poor teaching by simply moving Johnny and Betty down the street to a better institution. Unfortunately, the public education system is also set up to keep children in failing schools simply because there is nowhere else for them to go, and principals' hands are tied from holding their own staff to a higher teaching standard. A few examples I'll give you will clearly illustrate the convoluted process for firing inept teachers. In the Chicago public school system, according to the Chicago Tribune, a principal can determine that a teacher's performance is unsatisfactory only after spending at least 2 different days of observation inside that teacher's classroom. If the principal notifies the teacher about their unsatisfactory performance, they then must appoint a consulting teacher to create a remediation plan to try and improve the teacher's classroom technique. Remediation lasts a full 90 days before the principal can determine whether it was effective. If the performance does not improve, the teacher is served with charges and can demand a hearing from the Illinois State Board of Education. That process itself can take up to 6 months to complete. Meanwhile, the children suffer under an inept teacher. Now, if the teacher does not like the decision handed down at the end of the hearing process, they can appeal the decision in court, taking another 2 to 3 years to finalize the process. Throughout that entire frame, the teacher can decide to retire or take a buyout if one is offered to them. In New York, the process for firing inept teachers is just as lengthy and complex. It should also be noted that teachers in New York City can achieve tenure in just 3 short years, and state teachers outside the city can get tenure in 5 years. After this point, it becomes extremely difficult to fire a New York teacher, even if the teacher has assaulted a student, been found guilty of inappropriate sexual activity, or broken other laws. A report at Reason.com cites an example of a teacher who had been sending sexual emails to a 16-year-old student. School officials had possession of the emails, and the teacher even admitted to sending the emails. Even so, it took 6 years and plenty of expensive litigation before the school was finally able to fire that teacher. And although that teacher was not in a classroom during those 6 years, he was still on the school's payroll, landing around $350,000 before his termination was finalized. That's a true story, and there are more like it. Despite the seemingly hopeless outlook on the state of education in this country today, there are some bright spots that are starting to glow brighter. In New Orleans, where Hurricane Katrina wiped out most of the public school system, charter schools cropped up to serve the students of the area. Because these schools are not subject to the terms of teachers' unions, like public schools, they have the ability to hold teachers accountable for their performance. Those schools are doing a much better job of educating students, even in lower-income areas, than other public schools across the country with similar demographics. There is no doubt the public school system in this country is ready for an overhaul. The question becomes whether politicians and school officials have the courage and backbone to take the necessary steps to bring that overhaul to fruition. At no other time in our history has the American education system been in greater need of radical change. The place to start is abolishing tenure. Originally established in the late 1700s to protect academic freedom at religious schools, which are less than a fifth of the more than 4,700 U.S. colleges today, tenure has morphed into a guaranteed job for life, a benefit no longer enjoyed by any other segment of the U.S. workforce. Even the United Kingdom did away with tenure, in the late 1980s when then Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher implored the nation's colleges to become more productive. While not all of academia's problems can be laid to tenure's doorstep, tenure has hamstrung colleges' ability to fulfill their two fundamental missions of advancing knowledge and disseminating it. Here's why. U.S. colleges' once undisputed superiority is under siege. 51 of 76 U.S. universities lost ground in the list of the world's top 100 universities. Our country's bragging rights in science and engineering are especially in doubt. A National Science Foundation report notes that U.S. colleges are losing ground in two key measures of research quality. The percentage of the world's science and engineering articles published, and article citations. In the United States, research is the primary prerequisite for tenure, meaning that professors of all disciplines feel pressured to research, even if their subject area is static and less critical. Without tenure, it would be easier to shift research efforts toward emerging, fast-changing, and vital fields. Tenure locks in big costs and makes it difficult for universities to explore more productive teaching techniques. It's estimated that a college ties up between $10 million and $12 million of its endowment funds to support a single tenured professor for a 35-year career. A study of the teaching practices at the University of Texas at Austin indicated that UT Austin alone potentially could save $266 million a year if it could get half its professors to be as productive in teaching as the top 20%. Fire its least productive faculty and shift their small workload to other professors. Tenure also limits how nimble colleges can be in deploying their staff to subject areas that will better equip students for employment. As a study Center for College Affordability, a nonprofit research center, expressed it, with a tenure system, colleges are not able to reduce the number of medieval history professors in order to increase the number of information technology and business professors. Academic teaching techniques remain calcified despite a technological revolution in the last 30 years that enables professors to impart their knowledge in more effective and efficient ways. For example, a UCLA study of 6,768 U.S. undergraduate male teachers of science, technology, engineering, and math subjects, so-called STEM, found that 70% still rely on lectures, while only 33% used student inquiry-type methods. Professors' reluctance to use technology to revamp the way they teach is understandable. Tenured professors, of course, don't have to. However, it's to the detriment of students, especially those who are anesthetized by auditorium lectures that offer less opportunity to interchange than an online course. However, just as union work rules once prevented a railroad engineer from changing a light bulb in his locomotive, tenure protects professors from having to revamp the way they teach. While tenure's proponents argue that it can always be revoked, in fact, only 50 to 75 professors out of some 300,000 lose tenure annually. Tenure could be replaced with contracts similar to those in the business world. Merit-worthy professors could be offered multi-year contracts that give them time to prove themselves. Full professors could enjoy rolling contracts that provide reasonable amounts of job security. As in business, the contract could be bought out if the professor does not perform. In a Gallup poll, nearly two-thirds of 1,081 college and university provosts said they preferred long-term contracts to tenure. This would free up resources to staff according to what the outside world needs, both in graduates and in innovative ideas. Imagine that you ran a restaurant, a very prestigious, exclusive restaurant. To attract top talent, you guarantee all cooks and waiters job security for life. Not only that, because you value honesty and candor, you allow them to say anything they want about you and your cuisine, publicly and without fear of retribution. The only catch is that all cooks and waiters would have to start out as dishwashers or busboys for at least 10 years, during which time none of these protections would apply. It sounds absurd in the context of the food service industry for both you and your staff, but this system has governed academia for decades. Every college's business school has taught how restrictive work rules and high labor costs for many years made American automotive, electronics, and other industries less competitive. Now, universities need to adopt their own teachings and end the practice of tenure. Thanks for listening today. I'll be back again next weekend, God willing, same time, same station, and God bless America.